Chapter 26 Coruscant. It was like a replay of their first conference from days earlier, with Cal Omas, Admiral Pelion, and Admiral Neothel occupying the same seats at the conference table when Luke was escorted into the chamber. They and their aides looked up as the Jedi Master entered, and even before he seated himself, Omas said,
"So it appears you have good news for us."
Luke looked startled.
"What makes you think that, if I may ask?"
"Your expression," Omas said. "You were smiling. In these times, a smile from a Jedi is a hopeful sign."
"Oh."
Luke let his expression fall into more serious lines. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to mislead you. I just had some good news about my boy, Ben. He managed to save a number of lives on Lord just a few hours ago."
Neothel nodded, her protruding eyes surprisingly adept at projecting cool displeasure.
"Admirable. I'm sure he'll grow up into a fine Jedi Knight. Years and years from now, when this new Corellian crisis is behind us. For now, though..."
"For now," Pelion interrupted. "We could use some more universal, hopeful signs from the Jedi."
"I'm not sure about hopeful," Luke said. "Useful, perhaps. As you probably saw in the report I forwarded, there's little doubt that Thrak and Sal Solo sabotaged the Toriaz Station conference, or at least, through his inaction, permitted it to be sabotaged."
Omas's mouth turned downward.
"Unfortunately, the difference between those two behaviors is the difference between the most serious sort of crime and a non-crime."
"Non-crime?" Luke looked appalled. "You're joking."
"No."
Omas, for this moment, looked like a man impervious to humor. Certainly not a generator of amusement.
"Assuming that he did not pay for the information offered in the message he received, can you prove that he took the message seriously? That it was credible to him? Because he can always claim that he did not consider it a credible offer, that it was a communication from a crank, and therefore did not need to be acted on in any capacity."
Luke shook his head, unhappy to be thwarted by so negligible an obstacle. "Still, if a strike team were able to capture him and bring him to Coruscant, a criminal trial based on the assumption that he did buy the information could drag on for months, or longer, keeping Sal Solo out of commission during all that time, and that would be a boon to the peace process." The others exchanged glances.
"That," Neothel said, "it's a far more pragmatic suggestion than I expected from a Jedi. I like it."
Luke leaned back.
"Jedi are among the most pragmatic beings in the galaxy. We tend to operate under the assumption that it's better to get things done than to observe all the niceties. We consider justice to be of more consequence than law, for instance. Even justice is often overrated. Sometimes the imposition of justice prevents redemption."
"We'll consider that recommendation," Omas said. "But we have to consider it against the precedent it sets. If we kidnap a planetary ruler, even a sub-ruler who theoretically still belongs to our own government structure, despite our evident right to bring a suspected criminal into custody for trial, it opens a pragmatic precedent for the kidnapping of rulers within the Galactic Alliance. I might, in effect, be setting the stage for my own eventual kidnapping."
"We might have the blessing, even the unofficial blessing, of Sal Solo's chief rival on this," Luke said. "My sister reports a surreptitious meeting with Prime Minister Denjax Tepler, and a subtext of the meeting was apparently Tepler's concern that he'll survive, both politically and as a living being, only so long as Sal Solo views him as an asset. Pelion snorted, his expression amused but derisive.
That's what I love about politics, he said. We and a Corellian puppet ruler might have to conspire to remove a politician who's an impediment to us both before we can make headway in the peace process. How much sense does that make?
Luke spread his hands, palms up. I can't always make sense at the tables of politics. Let's see. I've finished bringing the underage Jedi trainees off Corellia, removing them as potential targets for retaliation. Mara came away from Coronet with information about Corellian mid-level government officers that you might be able to use as leverage on them, a matter for intelligence. My report included evaluations from many of the Jedi elsewhere in the galaxy, all pointing to a rise in support of Corellia's position in specific planetary systems. And that's most of what I had to report. Pelion nodded, his manner brisk.
Were you planning to remain on Coruscant, or return to Corellia and resume control of your squadron?
I was planning to return to Trollis.
We would appreciate it if you would stay here for a few days more, until we have a better sense of how the Jedi would best be posted during this crisis.
Luke nodded. As you wish.
And I'm sorry about your boy.
Luke's eyebrows rose. Sorry?
I don't mean about his accomplishment. I mean about his involvement.
Pelion gave Luke a wry smile.
The young go through wars and think that the experience is enough to teach them to fear such conflicts. And then, years later, their children go to war, and suddenly the parents learn what fear really means.
True enough, Luke said, and, taking Pelion's words as the beginning of a dismissal, rose. And I'm glad that you're still able to comprehend that fear. Corellian System, above Trollis.
He's on our tail! He's on our tail!
Cial Antilles didn't reply to the Sulliston gunner's musical trilling shout. She simply slapped the control yoke to the left. The Aleph-class starfighter didn't bank to port. Instead, there was a kick to the starfighter's side as thruster ports all along the starboard hull vented energy. The starfighter slipped to port, its orientation and forward speed not noticeably changing. Cial slapped down on the yoke's top, and the Aleph lurched again, this time dropping with stomach-jolting suddenness several meters as ports on the top of the hull vented. Laser fire from behind raked through empty space to the starboard side of the Aleph, then traversed to port, but missed the starfighter again as it dropped. Zweb Zahn, the Sulliston in the cockpit's right-hand seat, finally got the Aleph's starboard side turret spun around and facing aft. A graphic image of the X-Wing pursuing the Aleph jittered briefly in Zweb's targeting brackets. The Sulliston fired, and red wire-image versions of laser blasts converged on the X-Wing. In the monitor showing Cial and Zweb a holocam view of the Aleph's stern, they could see a live feed of the real laser beams hitting the real X-Wing. But the beams were pallid, far below combat strength, and the snub fighter's shields soaked them up without difficulty.
"That's a confirmed kill," the X-Wing pilot reported. "Good job, Antilles. Zahn?"
"Thank you, sir,"
Cial responded, mechanically. She began a quick check of her diagnostics boards, all but ignored during the mock battle, and saw no impairment to the Aleph's fighting abilities other than a slight energy drain from shield and laser usage. The X-Wing accelerated in a way the Aleph never could, causing Cial to bite her lip in envy and pulled up to the Aleph's starboard side.
"Opinions?" the pilot transmitted.
"I'm still not used to the lateral thrusters," Cial said.
She worked hard to keep a tone of complaint from creeping into her voice, though complaining was precisely what she wanted to do.
"It's just not the same as high-speed jinking."
"Maybe not," the X-Wing pilot said, "but you're handling them very well. You made me miss you. Zahn?"
the Sullustan considered.
"Starboard turret sticks," he said. "If it keeps doing that, we're going to get our butts shot off."
"Well, talk to your chief mechanic." The Sullustan's lips twisted, an expression of dissatisfaction.
"Wanted to know if turrets on the other Alephs were sticking. If so, bad sign."
"I'll ask. All right, this run is done. Bring her in."
The X-Wing abruptly veered away, banking back toward Trollis and the vessels orbiting her, including the Mon Cal carrier Blue Diver, Sial's new home. Jealous, Sial watched the nimbler snub fighter maneuver. She slowly began to turn in its wake. Her Aleph starfighter was capable of getting up to tremendous speeds, at a 5 interceptor speeds in atmosphere, but was so much more massive than the sort of craft she used to fly that simple banking maneuvers took much longer. The lateral thrusters with which she'd been dodging incoming fire just weren't the same as native nimbleness. She clicked her comboard over to receive only and said,
"I still hate it."
"Me too."
Zweb nodded vigorously, causing the fleshy folds of his face to wobble.
"It's like flying a freight speeder, which I've done."
"On Corellia?"
Sial nodded.
"Just a job, to save up credits for my education."
"Your father is a famous retired general, and you have to pay for your own education?"
"Not exactly. Every credit I put into my education fund, he matched with 4. But I had to earn. That's the Antilles way. No easy path."
Oriented on a course to intercept Blue Diver's orbit, she switched control over to the black and yellow R2 astromech situated in the well between and behind the pilot and gunner's seats.
"By the way, thanks."
"For?"
"Not making a deal of my being Corellian, or being a famous general's daughter."
Zweb waved her remarks away.
"I'm taking Longview. You're not Corellian daughter of famous general. He's father of famous Twee test pilot. Just wait."
Sial grinned.
"I like your attitude."
Test pilot. Her father had done some of that, too, over the years, but probably hadn't done so in a vehicle like the Aleph. By comparison with the X-Wings that her father so loved, the Aleph-class starfighters were flying tanks. Heavily armored 2-crew craft with overbuilt generators, the Alephs had been designed in the last months of the Yuuzhan Vong War, more than a decade before, as a 1-to-1 match for the Yuuzhan Vong Coral Skipper, a massive single-pilot organic starfighter protected by thick shells and by voids, mobile singularities that could slide in front of incoming lasers or missiles and swallow them completely. The Alephs didn't have any defenses that esoteric. Instead, they relied on their thick hulls and on shields powered by those overbuilt generators. Weapons included 2 turrets, one on either side of the ball-shaped cockpit, each equipped with quad-linked lasers, lasers that could be unlinked, permitting an unpredictable spray-fire pattern, an option to confound those coral skipper voids. Forward were the explosive tubes, one for concussion missiles and one for proton torpedoes. All in all, the Alephs packed a heavy punch. Heavy being the operative word for much of the vehicle's performance. But, and Sial winced, it was a shame the Alephs looked so blasted stupid. With their ball-shaped cockpits, reminiscent of TIE cockpits but larger, and the circular transparasteel viewports before both the pilot's and gunner's seats, with the smooth ball cockpit lines graduating to 2 trailing thruster pods, narrowing the farther they were from the cockpit, and with the turrets to either side of the cockpit, the Aleph looked like nothing so much as the head of a gigantic Twi'lek, trailing its headtails behind and wearing clumsy earmuffs. It was no wonder the Aleph test pilots, and just about everyone else who saw them, referred to the craft as Twees. Still, flying them was better than flying garbage scows, rescue shuttles, or tugs. Test pilot. Sial considered that. Much as she'd come to dislike the Twees in the few days she'd been flying them, she realized that it wouldn't be fair to this class of starfighters
if she didn't demonstrate every one of their positive traits for their GA evaluators. It also wouldn't be fair to the Antilles family name. Now that she'd reclaimed her name, she owed it to her family to put a bit more polish on it. She needed to be able to run this craft through maneuvers so exacting that onlooking pilots would have no idea how she did it. She switched her comm board back onto broadcast.
Gray 1, this is 4. Over.
Go ahead, 4. Over.
Would it be all right if I dropped down into Trollis's atmosphere before I return to the diver? I'd like to run this unit through some paces. Atmospheric speed and heat tests, some aerobatics. Over.
That's showing some initiative, 4. You're authorized. Over.
Thanks and out.
Sial returned the comm board to its previous status. Zweb gave her a sorrowful look.
Going to fly me dizzy, aren't you?
Sial nodded, her expression sympathetic.
Only till you throw up.
All right.
Lord City, Lord. Ben returned to Dr. Otham's offices just as the elderly scholar was commencing her initial evaluation. He walked in, seeing the real tassels set out on the main table and a hologram of them floating above, each tassel labeled. Rotham was speaking.
Top to bottom, as that seems, from internal evidence, to be the order in which they're to be read. Hello, Ben.
Hello. Ben moved forward to stand behind Jason's chair. He stared up at the hologram.
So, Dr. Rotham continued, number 1 at the top is from Ferrer, a dead world, its population scattered. The knotting technique was originally for recording, and in some superstitious cultures, magically influencing names. Its message, he will remake himself, or perhaps rename himself. The two concepts being identical in this context. Next is the one I translated for you earlier, from the Bith species, Allagar race. He will ruin those who deny justice. The scarlet and black one was easy, as it was the second of the tactile writing systems I learned, a recording technique used by the prisoners on Kessel. He will choose the fate of the weak.
Though Jason didn't move, Ben felt a jolt of emotion from him. Nalani must have felt it too. She gave Jason a curious look, but he did not acknowledge it, keeping his attention on Dr. Rotham. The scholars seemed to be oblivious to the exchange.
I can't determine the meaning of the next one in sequence, the poisonous-looking yellow and green one. After that comes a very tricky one. The red, yellow, and pale green tassel is actually a representation of a flower arrangement from the old Alderanian language of flowers. Imagine it as a bouquet in a vase, the red and yellow splotches constituting the petals, and the green the stems, and you get a sense of it. Its meaning is, he will choose how he will be loved. Actually, instead of he, it should be I, but I'm taking the liberty of assuming that the third person is to be used here, as it is everywhere else.
Speaking of which, Nalani interrupted, is it definitely he, or could it also be read as she throughout?
Dr. Rotham shook her head.
It isn't defined in all the tassels, but everywhere it is, it's distinctly he. Where was I? Oh, yes. After that, a very simple one. The gray and brown one is from a still extant Coruscanti subculture of indigents, transients who pride themselves on being jobless, living by theft and begging. They leave messages for others of their kind, symbols on the walls of shops, to say, for instance, that a restaurateur is an easy touch. This three-dimensional representation of their language states, he will win and break his chains.
She continued. Ben, increasingly bored, began to lose focus. taking only distracted note of her translations.
"He will shed his skin and choose a new skin. He will strengthen himself through sacrifice. He will crawl through his cloak. He will know brotherhood. He will make a pet, by which I don't mean he will tame some creature, but that he will somehow fabricate a pet."
Mostly Ben kept his attention on Jason, for on one or two other occasions the revelation of a tassel's meaning again caused his emotions to spike to the point where Ben could detect them. Finally, Dr. Rotham's translations reached the end.
"This one you already knew. Ryloth. To Huip culture. He will strengthen himself through pain. To be honest, I don't know whether the order of presentation is significant. It could be random, or it could add up to a specific thought. I just have no way of knowing."
Jason nodded. "That's all very helpful, Doctor. You skipped one." He stood and reached out to the hologram, his fingertips touching a tan tassel featuring jagged black lines.
"Yes, I could not translate that one. Though I've seen the recording method before, the zigzag patterns, the arrays of protruding claws and teeth."
Dr. Rotham looked uncertain.
"In statuary and figurines from the world of Zeost."
This time it was Nalani who looked startled. Jason accepted the information with a simple nod.
"It means something like, he will be drawn from peace into conflict. Or maybe, his life will be balanced between peace and conflict."
The scholar gave him a curious look.
"How do you know?"
"Believe it or not, I just feel it. The tassel's meaning is imbued within it, in a fashion that only a Force-wielder can read."
"I can't read it," Nalani said.
Jason shrugged.
"Maybe when you've broadened your range of Force-related learning a bit."
"What's Zeost?" Ben asked.
"One of the worlds central to the origins of the Sith,"
Nalani said, her tone low, as if she wanted to avoid being overheard.
"There's actually a substantial Sith influence to this collection of statements."
Jason gestured at the hologram.
"Several of them seem to be paraphrases of portions of the Sith creed. The one about victory and chains, for instance. What we have here is an item fabricated by someone who is at least as familiar with Sith matters as a Jedi historian would be."
"I hope it is only a historian,"
Dr. Rotham said.
"One last thing I can tell you is this. I brought in a bead crafter to look at these items, and he's certain that they were crafted by different hands. So you're not dealing with a single individual who is expert in all these recording techniques. You're dealing with someone who has collected them, arranged for their assembly, rather than someone who has fabricated them all, which is a considerable relief to me. Because the alternative would be that I have an academic rival I've been unaware of all these decades."
She drew a hand over her brow, miming a gesture of relief. Jason gave her a smile.
"Doctor, your help has been invaluable, and we've asked you to do far too much work in far too short an amount of time. I do appreciate it."
She beamed up at him.
"I consider it my chance, so late in life, to offer some thanks to the Jedi for all they've done."
"We'll leave you now, but if anything does occur to you about any of the tassels, any of the translations, don't hesitate to get a message to us."
Jason wrapped the collection of tassels in a cloth and returned it to his belt pouch.
"Good luck with your investigation, Jedi Solo."
Once the Jedi were in the corridor outside Dr. Rotham's quarters and headed toward Nalani's speeder, Jason asked,
"So, how was the rest of your day, Ben?"
"Oh, pretty good, I guess."
Ben struggled to look and feel nonchalant.
I found the shuttle.
Jason smiled. Well, that couldn't have been too difficult. You started out at the spaceport.
Not your shuttle.
Jason frowned.
Whose? The shuttle that escaped Toriaz Station.
Jason almost stumbled, and Ben suppressed the urge to laugh. Jason said,
Wait, are you sure?
Ben nodded.
The transponder code is a match, and so is the design. It's a Sentinel-class lander with the weapon systems stripped out.
Sentinel-class shuttles, slightly scaled up and more heavily armored cousins of the Lambda-class shuttle that Jason piloted, were familiar sights along the galactic space routes.
How did you find it?
Nalani asked. She'd been impressed by Ben's efforts during and after Hwar's spectacular suicide, and sounded impressed again. Ben had to work hard not to preen. Ben grimaced. This was going to be difficult to explain, to put into words. On the other hand, Nalani was a Jedi.
I waited around for a while, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I guess I wasn't thinking, more like feeling, and I kept noticing when shuttles landed. They kind of drew my attention, even when transports and cargo ships didn't, which seemed weird at the time.
Nalani nodded.
The Force was guiding you. You were open to it.
I guess. And then I remembered something my mother says a lot. She says that any detail, no matter how small, could turn out to be important. And I remembered about the shuttle from Toriaz Station. Mom's a spy, you know.
Nalani grinned. I know.
So I went through my datapad, all Jason's notes on details we haven't had time to go through, and I decided to see if the spaceport records showed anything about that shuttle. And there it was, parked half a kilometer from where the Y-Wing blew up.
Who's it registered to?
Jason asked. Ben pulled out his datapad and opened it. He'd left all that information on the screen.
A human woman named Brescia Sio. She's from Kaminor.
She wasn't at the shuttle. She'd just paid for a week's worth of hangar space. She left no contact information. The spaceport authority thought she was staying aboard, but the ship's systems were all shut down. I told Lieutenant Samron. He's got somebody watching it now.
Very good, Jason said. But what if this Brescia Sio sneaks aboard and takes off when Samron's guard is snoozing?
Then the transmitter we stuck on top of the hull will tell us where she goes. Ben shrugged, as if the matter were of no consequence.
Jason laughed. Good work. And what did you do with the rest of your time?
Ben scowled at him.
Now you're making fun of me.
Jason nodded.
You're getting so good at what you do, if we don't make fun of you, you'll have a Colosso Lando Calrissian-sized ego.
That would be fun. Ben modulated his voice to something like the smooth, insinuating tones of the old Solo family friend. He turned toward Nalani.
Hello, I'm Ben Skywalker.
Oh, that's ghastly, she said.
And I'm trying to figure out whether I'm more suave or more debonair. Maybe you can help.
Stop it, she said.
I'll pour the wine, and you tell me what you like best about me.
Jason, now he talks too much.